Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 100th anniversary of one of the most influential events of the 20th century is coming up in just a couple of months. November 7th marks the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, which brought Lenin's Bolsheviks to power. This event was also the spark of a conflict between two socioeconomic and political systems that would dominate the century. My guest today will be giving the University of Tulsa Cadenhead Settle Lecture on history this coming Monday evening on Russia 1917, some reflections on the 100th anniversary. Dr. Donald Raleigh is a distinguished professor of Russian history and director of the Center for Slavic, Eurasian, and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He's authored, translated, and edited numerous books on modern Russian history, including Revolution on the Volga, Experiencing Russia's Civil War, and his most recent, Soviet Baby Boomers, which was also shortlisted for the Pushkin House Prize in Great Britain. He'll be speaking Monday evening at 7:30 at Tyrrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus in a free lecture on Reflections on the Russian Revolution. Donald Raleigh, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You're going to be speaking about the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and in particular, I would assume, given it's this fall, the October or November Revolution, depending on what calendar you're using, which, of course, brought Lenin and the Bolsheviks to power and changed the Russian Empire into the Soviet Union. Will that be celebrated this fall in 21st century Russia?
Well, that's a very good question. It will be, but in a muted way. And here, let me indulge myself a little bit, because in the lecture itself, I'm going to emphasize the extent to which the times impact how we understand great historical events. And let me begin with an example. In 1997, which was the 80th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, but, you know, a few short years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, as you know, every November 7th, there were major parades in Moscow. All that stopped in Russia. There were some minor academic conferences, but outside of Russia, in the U.S. and in Europe, there were absolutely no commemorative events, no conference, symposium, anything commemorating the Russian Revolution. I was invited to Brazil to a conference there, which was highly ironic because it was the most important conference at the that year on the Russian Revolution outside of Russia, and it took place in Brazil only because the military dictatorship had been recently replaced, and when the military dictatorship was in power in Brazil, my colleagues there couldn't even teach about Russia or the Russian language even. There was no talk of revolution when the military dictatorship's in power. It's over. They're celebrating the 80th anniversary, and the rest of the world is sort of quiet. So, you know, now we're 20 years beyond that, and an awful lot has changed on the world stage. And as a result, you know, there will be some major events, but again, in a very different sort of way than we might expect.
So how do Russians view the events of 1917 today?
Well, you know, it depends who you ask. But if we ask Vladimir Putin, and I think, you know, his input here is critical, particularly in regard to shaping the overall contours of public discussion of the event. Putin, already at the start of the new millennium and coming to power, he said something to the effect that, you know, Russia has overfulfilled its plan for revolutions over the past 50 years. And then a few years ago, in being asked about that, you know, he said, enough is enough. We don't need any revolution. And, you know, I think several things are going on here. One is that, obviously, revolution as a concept in Russia today needs to be discredited by the leadership, because they don't want to make revolution, they don't want to even discuss it as a possible political scenario, right, to for Russia today, for people who might be opposed to Putin. So I think that's a big issue. But another really important issue that's impacting how the revolution is celebrated today is the recent 100th anniversary of World War I. And in conjunction with that, you know, there was so much attention everywhere in the world, really, on the Great War. But keep in mind that in the Soviet Union, there were no World War I monuments or memorials. And that was the case because you know, the war went poorly for Russia, and the fact that it went poorly contributed to revolution. So the revolution became the major story, the dominant storyline, the major foundational narrative of the Soviet Union, not the war. So there were no war monuments erected in the Soviet days. Lots of monuments to the revolutions, revolutionary leaders, to Lenin, etc.
And that's despite, and that, I would say that that's despite 3.5 million casualties during World War I.
Right. But, you know, what's happening in academic scholarship is looking at the period from 1914 to 21 as sort of a continuum. As one person called it, a continuum of crisis. World War I, revolution, civil war, famine, you know, with the number of deaths mind-boggling in many ways. But on the anniversary of the 100th anniversary, what happened in Russia is now a major memorial, a major monument, went up in Moscow. It opened in 2014 on the 100th anniversary. Putin and the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church were there in tandem. And in this new sort of sanitized view of the Russian leadership, the argument goes that the war sort of proved the heroism of the Russian, you know, rank-and-file Russian soldier, and certainly the patriotism of people on the home front. And now all that's sort of memorialized in a massive monument, again, that underscores the heroism of the Russian people in World War I. So what I'm suggesting here is that World War I had been in the shadow of the Russian Revolution and it stepped outside of that shadow. But now the war is casting a shadow on the revolution. And you know, there have been only muted academic conferences, not a lot of public discussion of the revolution. Serious scholars, historians, of course, continue to study it, but by no means to the same extent that this was true years ago. Again, I think the political situation now, you know, World War I, Russia was doing a great job. Revolution interrupted Russia's would-be victory in war. Revolution is not a good thing. That's sort of the official line of the state.
And yeah, it was interesting as I was sort of reading up on the Russian Revolution. I fell into the rabbit hole of the Romanovs, and I was surprised to learn that after the fall of communism, the Romanovs have been rehabilitated and actually canonized by the Orthodox Church. So obviously, Russians have a complex relationship with this event in their history.
Absolutely. In the immediate aftermath of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the word revolution was out. Right. It was there was a knee-jerk reaction, a rejection of the revolution among many, not everyone, obviously, of course. And another example that sort of impacted me, my very first book was called Revolution on the Volga.
Right.
And in the second half of the 1990s, it was being translated in Russia, but publishers didn't want to publish it. There was no money to begin with, and they needed to find a sponsor. But they didn't like the title, Revolution on the Volga, so they changed it to The Political Fate of Provincial Russia, a very bland topic without revolution in the title.
In fact, you've spent most of your career looking at how provincial Russia has reacted
right.
to the revolution, the counter-revolution, I mean the civil war that followed the revolution, as well as how communism affected that era of southern Russia along the Volga, around Saratov. Well, let me ask you another question before we get into that, which is, as you look at the revolution, many historians today believe that this was the most important event of the 20th century. Would you agree?
I certainly would. And you know, even now, I mean, if you think about the impact across the century, and it really is ongoing, you know, despite the discrediting of revolution in today's world, but for one thing, it created a different alternative to historical development that had tremendous appeal to what we now call the Third World, right? Those countries that were shedding the yoke of imperialism, a process that began after World War I. It sped up during World War II. And then what the Soviets tried to do was create a whole new society that was different. And I would argue, you know, we talk a lot about the impact on the world, but there are woefully few studies that really look at this in depth. But take our own history. Look at the Red Scare in the United States in the 1920s. And I know that many argue that we would never have had a New Deal hadn't it been for the Russian Revolution. and the fear that if ordinary people become angry, this could lead to sweeping change.
It's looking at our history through a lens of this fear of what, the alternative future looks like. And so it spurred our development in space. It spurred the New Deal. It spurred a lot of different things.
Well, if you think, absolutely. And, during when the Great Depression hit Europe and the United States, the Soviet Union was launching its major industrialization campaign. And at the same time then, in the next 5 years or so, you have the marching into power of right-wing military dictatorships across, Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, all of this going on, and, there was a crisis in Western democracy, and many intellectuals even wondered, is mass democracy over, and, is the Soviet Union the wave of the future? This, of course, is before the Stalinist terror became well-known and things like that. But then after World War II, again, the Soviet model served as a stimulus to many countries that were emerging from colonialism. And then, of course, the Cold War begins. And for that next, I'm not sure, Rich, when you were born, but I was born in 1949. Right. And my whole childhood, young adulthood, really until the dissolution of the Soviet Union, was very much colored by the Cold War, where you have two very universalizing ideologies in competition for the hearts and minds of the whole world. I mean, that's a very powerful force in world history. Again, obviously, World War II, the Great War itself, these are momentous events as well. And we have no metric for saying one is more important than the other. But in terms of lasting legacy, impact on people's thinking, I would argue I give an edge to the Russian Revolution. Mm. And even now, there's nothing like failure, right? With the dissolution of the Soviet Union, revolution is dismissed, but we could also say that the ideals of the revolution remain important, right? I mean, the revolution was made, and maybe not in Lenin's mind, but I think many people were idealistic, they were hopeful, they wanted to create a better life, right? And those issues remain important today.
It's really interesting, in the wake of the Cold War, when you talk to people involved in foreign policy and international relations, sometimes they'll actually, even though the Cold War was as messy as the world today, looking in hindsight, they think of a far simpler world during the Cold War when you had these two ideological mindsets that sort of was perhaps an easier way to negotiate their way as opposed to today where, and what's really interesting is all those problems still existed. They were just swept under the rug during the Cold War.
Well, but, I remember growing up, I grew up in Chicago. We had duck and cover air raid drills.
Yeah, there was existential fear.
It was fear. I was very much impacted by that. And then I remember how much we prayed in church for the conversion of the atheist communists. it was really in your face in a daily sort of way, right? My graduate education was funded by federal fellowships to study critical languages and the Soviet enemy, the other. I mean, it impacted everything. And then look at the military spending, right? How our lives would be different if there hadn't been a Cold War. That's pretty mind-boggling to speculate over, too, right? If those resources had been put in some other, to just improve people's daily lives.
My guest today is Donald Raleigh. He is the Distinguished Professor of Russian History and the Director of the Center for Slavic, Eurasian, and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of numerous books and articles on the Soviet Union and in Russian history. He'll be giving the 2017 Cadenhead Settle Lecture in History Monday evening at Tyrrell Hall on Russia, 1917, some reflections on the 100th anniversary of the revolution. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the things you wrote about is that you said, how you view the revolution depends on what's going on today. So how the events of today were, you're looking at investigations in how Russia may have influenced, what influence it had on our most recent presidential election. You have Russian and United States relations that, in some ways, diplomatically, at one of its lowest ebbs, where you're seeing the seizing of, sovereign diplomatic properties in both countries. How does this affect how we view the events of 100 years ago?
Well, yeah, I'd return, Rich, here to my earlier point about, you know, in 1997, when there was almost no public discussion, very limited public discussion of the Russian Revolution. At that point, you know, Russia was reeling from the aftermath of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it introduced market capitalism and democracy, elections, and people's lives deteriorated. And Russia was dismissed on the world stage as an economic basket case, a disaster. Really, it went from superpower to ignored, rejected former superpower. Think of the psychological impact of being a former superpower. And as I mentioned, you know, 20 years have passed. What's happened during those 20 years? An amazing amount. First of all, Russia's, and I think this is the lesson for us, I mean, we totally dismiss Russia. 20 years later, you know, we've seen this remarkable resurgence of Russia on the world stage. And, you know, that's impacted, of course, interest in World War I and on the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. And Putin came to power and he said, Russia will be great or Russia will not be. Forces that had been set in motion before he came to power and had nothing to do with him, but he pursued them. The economy stabilized, began to roar. People began to consume. His popularity shot up. And, you know, Russia has great pretensions. And, you know, we dismissed those. And now Russia, once again, is, and in fact, even a year ago, some of our top military brass wondered if Russia might not be our greatest enemy and threat, which is alarming in and of itself, that type of formulation. And I regret the rapid deterioration in relations. You know, that said, I think all of the further studies will show that, yes, Russia was probably very deeply involved in, you know, destabilizing things. But we don't know the other side, right? I think this is part of a larger picture of what rival powers often do on the sly without any public discussion of it. Increasingly, the evidence shows that the current administration, that there were ties with Russia, the conversations, all the stuff that's in the news. It's very hard I have no crystal ball. I have no access to information that's not in the public domain here. But that Russia would want to impact our elections, it comes as no surprise to me.
I think next time.
The fact that Putin personally disliked Hillary Clinton and the Russian media maligned her in the months leading up to the election. Before the election, I remember having discussions, you know, when our public opinion polls showed that Hillary would win. My Russian colleagues in Moscow laughed at me, told me I was very naive. They told me that Donald Trump would certainly win because that's what they heard in the media in Russia. So I think there's more to the story that'll be unfolding in time. But the lesson for us is, you know, I think there's several. One is that, you know, we probably prematurely dismissed Russia rather than embracing it in a way of you would, an equal. Secondly, I wouldn't underestimate Russia's willingness to, again, go it alone. That's what they did with the revolution. They tried to create a modern society, a different iteration of modernity, whole cloth, something that no one had done before. They do think in this way, and they do have aspirations for great power. And I think for us, the lesson is to find ways to sit down with them and talk. And instead of that, it's becoming increasingly a tit for tat, somewhat reminiscent of the Cold War. And I'm not suggesting it's easy dealing with Russia, particularly a resurgent Russia. It certainly isn't. But I think it's important to try. I think it's important to make that a top priority.
You know, as you say that, I think of how different our reaction was to the end of the Soviet Union as opposed to the end of World War II, where we immediately helped rebuild Japan and Germany. We certainly did try to influence the form of their government. And, of course, in Europe, it was a divided Germany. But after the end of the Cold War, we didn't really try. I mean, we did try to influence how their government would be set up, but more often than not, we were there to exploit.
Well, you know,
you think of all the businessmen who came in. It was like, how do we make a buck off of Russia?
Well, their expectation was there'd be a new Marshall Plan, right? And when that didn't materialize, and the market reforms and the election, people's lives just were turned upside down. And they lived in the 1990s through the equivalent of the Great Depression. I don't think many Americans appreciate that. It was a breakdown in all sorts of things that people had taken for granted. So ordinary people often associated, democracy and market economy with economic turmoil, instability, etc. And among the more patriotic conservative elements in Russia, there was widespread speculation that maybe the whole dissolution was part of an American plot, right, hatched by the CIA to undermine the Soviet Union and then Russia. So there's a lot of suspicion as, in terms of our involvement. Gee, they helped. They promoted Perestroika and Gorbachev, but then they dropped us, right?
Right.
Now we did have AID money, USAID money, but a lot of it was just misdirected, and it was not a huge amount by any means.
I want to ask you in our remaining time about your most recent full book, which was the Oral Histories with Soviet Baby Boomers.
Mm-hmm.
What did you find? Did you find that in many ways their life had a lot of similarities to yours growing up, other than the fact that one is American in a huge consumer economy and one was in the Soviet Union, as far as their attitudes towards their government, attitudes towards that particular point in history?
Well, there was, after World War II, the emergence of a global youth culture, youth movement. And there were things that were going on in the Soviet Union that were, again, very reminiscent of major trends and developments, including youth movement going on in Europe, United States, and elsewhere. What I sort of argue in the book is that, the people I wrote about were pretty much the post-war generation. They got everything Soviet power could offer. They did have happy childhoods. They had pampered childhoods, comparatively speaking. No one among them became a dissident, but they all sympathized with the need to reform. So no one expected the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but all of them were ready for it when the time came. And that was the broader lesson there, that they were, the Soviet Union sort of reformed itself out of existence. And people were, again, they weren't dissident-minded, but they were sympathetic to broad appeals for fundamental change, particularly openness, free travel. They wanted better lives. They were living better than any previous Soviet generation, but they wanted more. So the big argument in the book is that the period from 1945 to 85, when Gorbachev came to power, 40 years of peaceful evolutionary organic change, when you could say, nothing really happened compared to the previous 40 years, which was punctuated by revolution, war, famine, Stalin, terror, etc., that those 40 years of peaceful evolutionary change, the changes are much deeper, I would argue, than and significant than these revolutionary onslaught against society in the first half of the century.
My guest today is Russian historian Donald Raleigh. He'll be giving the 2017 Cadenhead Settle Lecture on the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution Monday evening at Terrell Hall. Now, you're currently working on a biography of Leonid Brezhnev. Now, when I think of Brezhnev, especially growing up through the lens of Cold War politics, he was sort of the personification of the Soviet faceless bureaucrat who maneuvered, survived purges, and was sort of this faceless sort of a gray personality and made it to the top of becoming the leader of the Soviet Union. Obviously, I don't think you'd want to write a biography about that person if that's actually the reality. What interests you in Leonid Brezhnev?
Well, I want to point out a few things. First of all, that representation, that sort of a caricature, really, of Brezhnev that was widespread in the U.S. media during the Cold War, right? It's really a Cold War representation. Secondly, Brezhnev was in power longer than any leader in Russia or the Soviet Union in the 20th century, except for Stalin. He was in power from 1964 to 1982. And again, during that time, there was an awful lot of peaceful evolutionary organic change. Third, when Brezhnev died, and 3 years later, Gorbachev came to power. Gorbachev, when you implement reform and promote reform, you have to cast aspersions on the previous system, right, to justify your reforms. So this notion that the Brezhnev era was an era of stagnation when nothing happened was also, of course, reinforced by Gorbachev. And people subscribe to it. There's no doubt about it. But after a decade in the 1990s of misery, poverty, turmoil, crime, things that people hadn't really endured before, at the start of the millennium, there were every year annual public opinion polls of the most popular leaders in 20th century Russia. Brezhnev came out number one every year until 2 years ago when Putin slightly surpassed him. It was Brezhnev. It's very bizarre looking at the results because Lenin's up there and Nicholas II as well. But people looked upon the Brezhnev era as the good old days.
Interesting.
Yeah, and there was an expression, confidence in tomorrow. You know, we knew that we'd be paid, that we'd have health care, that our kids would go to school free. We knew all that. We didn't have to worry about these things. So there's been a bit of a sentimental romanticization of the Brezhnev to a certain extent, but he was a master politician. Otherwise, he wouldn't have come to power in the other superpower.
Right.
He was an amazing politician. Had he retired in 1975 when he wanted to, we probably would have had a very different understanding of him in the media here. But his colleagues in the Kremlin wouldn't let him, in part because they were sparring for power, and keeping him in power was in their best interest until one of them thought he was in a position to emerge on top. So the result was, in the last 7 years, Brezhnev was infirm. He suffered some strokes. For a while, he was addicted to sleep medication. He had lots of health problems. There's a certain degradation of his personality taking place, yet there were also moments of great lucidity in which he really tried to affect politics and impact politics up until the very end. And by the way, he kept we call them diaries, they're more like work notebooks, and these diaries have finally been published, but we didn't know this about him, and they offer some really unique insights into what made the man tick. So he's a very complex personality, and a very colorful, positive one initially. He was very popular when he first came to power in the Soviet Union because he replaced Khrushchev, who at the time was much maligned. Mm. Again, these political understandings, they change over time. They reflect the current situation both constrains and enables our understanding of the past. And that includes not only events like the revolution, but even our evaluations of political figures such as someone like Brezhnev. Again, since the start of the millennium, he's been very popular in Russia.
Well, we look forward to your lecture. Donald Rawley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Donald Rawley is a distinguished professor of Russian history and director of the Center for Slavic, Eurasian, and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He'll be giving the 2017 Cadenhead Settle Lecture in History Monday evening at 7:30 in Tyrrell Hall Auditorium on Russia, 1917, Some Reflections on the 100th Anniversary. That lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.